So this event is hosted, as I mentioned before, by Our Revolution Chico, as well as the Chico Women's March. It is the second in a series of independent town halls. We would like to begin by acknowledging the occupation of Machupta territory in this place that we often call Chico.
Good afternoon. My name is Allie Metters-Knight. I'm a tribal member with the Machupta Indian tribe here in Chico. The reason why I've made my presence known on congressional and Senate panels is because locally we've had a long misunderstanding going on between the political affiliation of being a Native American, or what they call an American Indian, in the United States. I am not a race, technically. I am a political affiliation. I'm enrolled in my sovereign nation of a Machupta Indian tribe. I am a citizen of that nation. That makes me politically affiliated with my tribal nation. It does not make it a race. Second, that relationship I have is a political affiliation is with the House and the Senate. We're here with Congress. We have a congressional relationship on a federal level as a sovereign nation. Our relationship with local municipals like the city and the county and the state, they are subsequently underneath the federal government as the power structure. So the tribes deal directly with the federal government, the Congress. That is the trust relationship. So locally, for years, I have seen so much local activity to oppress and put down the tribal people. And that has to end. And a lot of it is based on the very, very first assumption that Native Americans are a race of people and they've been eliminated from this area and have lost all their rights. And that is not. The Machupta tribe was re-recognized in 1992. I moved out to Chico in 1993, just after graduation. Throughout all these years, I have seen the most racist, oppressive actions by the local representatives that do not even understand how our government even works, especially on a federal level. And additionally, what we are facing on a federal level as Native Americans is the assumption that the executive branch, which we have a three-branch government, these folks will be serving on the legislative branch if they make it through the office. We also have a judicial branch, and we have an executive branch that is a commander-in-chief over the military. If you are a law officer, if you are in the military, he's your boss. However, he is not the boss of the Senate or our Congress, and he's not the boss of anybody in the judicial system. And we have let the assumption of all that power go to the executive branch, and it is leaching into Indian country. We are literally the canaries in the coal mine, telling you what's happening to us will happen to you next. So I'm here as a representative from the Machupta Indian tribe to stand up for my entitled rights on a federal level, and also to make every person in this community accountable for the political decisions that are made to oppress the people or to empower them. So I'm here, and I really am thankful to be here, because I know that my community, my political affiliates throughout the year, we did not have the chance. We have served in armies before we were allowed to vote. The reason why we were kept from voting, and you will believe this, is because they assumed we didn't pay taxes. And so we didn't have the right to vote. And that didn't happen until 1924 was the Snyder Act that basically said you're not prisoners of war, you can leave Indian reservations. After that, we really didn't get to vote until the 1950s. So I'm really honored to be up here in 2018 as a very proud Native woman standing up for my tribe and my political affiliation. And I'm here, and I'm very honored to share the panel with everybody here, and we're going to have a great time. Thank you today.
We'll start with moderator introductions. I am here to introduce Diane Suzuki Brobeck. Diane is a pillar in the Chico community. She is involved with activism and has been since the 1970s and locally since the 1980s. She fell in love with Upper Park in 1976 and has called Butte County her home ever since. She has served on the board of the Chico Peace and Justice Center, on the County Council of the Butte County Green Party, and is the coordinator of Beyond Violence Alliance. She has hosted the One World Music on KZFR Community Radio for many years and is currently active with a newly formed group called Concerned Citizens for Justice, which formed in response to local police killings. She was honored to work with the organizers of the last two women's marches and is excited to see the movement of people power in action. Her most revolutionary act is her devotion to commuting by bicycle through our beloved community along Big Chico Creek to work, to the Saturday Farmers Market, and many other destinations. Welcome, Diane.
And Lindsay Wood. Lindsay is an environmental consultant who specializes in avian, herptile, fisheries, and watershed management. She has been involved in water policy since 2012 and is currently the water policy advisor for local campaigns in District 1. She served on the Butte County Forest Advisory Committee from 2015 to 2017 and the Butte Environmental Council Board of Directors locally. She has conducted international research on avian diversity in San Ramon, Costa Rica, and leatherback turtle nesting success in Tortuguero, Costa Rica. She is an avid outdoors woman who enjoys mountain biking, rafting, picking wildflowers, fishing, and birding.
So without further ado, we'd like to introduce our candidates that we have here today. We will give them 2 minutes to do kind of an elevator pitch and let us know who they are. And we will start with Pat Harris.
Thank you. My name is Pat Harris. I came here today as I was driving up. I was going to come talk about all the problems that are occurring across the state and specifically here in Butte County. And then I saw a sign that said, Doug LaMalfa, he's one of us. So I realized, I guess you guys don't have any problem because apparently you're all millionaires who get huge farm subsidies. I am running for Senate, and I'm running for the very basic reason. I believe that where we are in this time in history is unique. I believe we have reached a point in the history that is a turning point. We have, for years, worked across the aisle, compromised, managed to get legislation through. That ended about 8 years ago with the election, or 9 years ago now with the election of President Obama. Yet the Democratic Party continues to talk about compromising, working across the aisle. It is a failed policy at this point. The Democratic Party needs to get a backbone. The Democratic Party's got to fight, and we need fighters. We need people who are willing to stand up and willing to actually go into Washington. And Dianne Feinstein stated not too long ago, we don't need rabble-rousers in Washington. That's exactly what we need. We need people who are going to go and raise hell. That's who I am. I've been a civil rights and criminal defense attorney for the past 25 years. I've taken on companies like Pfizer, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. I took on the Catholic Church over the abuse of children. I have fought every day of my life in a courtroom. I don't have to, as one of our opponents likes to get up and say, he's going to go to Washington and he's going to get up there and he's going to fight when he gets there. Well, guess what? I've been doing it already. I don't have to go there to do it. I've been doing it. Again, it's Pat Harris. I'm sure we'll get to answer questions about issues. I look very much forward to doing this. Thanks so much for having us here.
Thank you, Pat. Next, we'd like to introduce Dave Hildebrand.
Hey, everyone. My name is David Hildebrand, and I'm the corporate-free, democratic, socialist, pro-union, working-class candidate for U.S. Senate. That's a lot to unpack, and I'm sure we'll unpack much of that tonight, so I'll keep it short now in my 2 minutes. I worked on the Bernie Sanders campaign for over 70 hours a week, and a lot of you will say, how can you do that? Well, I just did it around my full-time job. And say, wait, what? When did you sleep? Well, I kind of slept. I got up in the morning and went to work and drove straight from my job to Bernie Sanders' office, and I worked for another 8 hours. And we got out of there about midnight when we were done building the canvassing binders for the next day. So we canvassed the whole area. I went from phone banking all the way up to staging location director for CD6, which I'm sure you are familiar with because you're next door. But what happened after 2016 is I saw an opening. And I left it on the back burner because we had other things to do at the time. I jumped on a local school board campaign. We came very close to winning that, but we were able to push out the realtor who was running for the school board, so that was good. Then I jumped on the SB 562 canvassing efforts and did that. And then March rolled around, or actually February rolled around, I'm like, who's going to run against Feinstein? We have to have someone who's not for $7 billion for war, who's not for voting for Iraq, who's not for spying on American citizens. So I said, I'm going to wait, see if anyone jumps in. By the end of February, no one jumped in, so I jumped in. And I said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this to win. My girlfriend was like, okay, whatever. And then she saw me organizing, she saw me turn our second bedroom into an office. She saw me actually going out across the state since last March 2017, and talking to communities. I've been up here, I think, 5 or 6 times now, in just in Chico area alone. So she watched me do that, and she said, you know what, when you started, I didn't think you were serious. But now I see that you are, and she's backing me. I have volunteers all over the state, and we're currently doing canvassing, and that's my time, so I guess I gotta cut it off there, but we'll answer tons of questions, I'm sure, tonight.
Thank you, David. Folks,
thanks.
Welcome, John Thompson Parker.
How much time do I have here?
You have 2 minutes and an elevator pitch.
2 minutes, okay. Okay, John Thompson Parker. So I'm running here because, you know, it's time's up. It's not only time's up for misogyny, it's time's up for these brutal murders of black and brown youth by police and ICE. And these global warming, and to end these endless wars that drench our world in blood and refugees' sorrow. You know, the Democrats and Republicans gave a $700 billion handout to the military. And you ask, why did they do that? Well, militarism, it attempts to silence the people, and it also ensures the profits of the industrial monopolists. But if we can take control over the privatized industries of production, then we can produce for human needs, not for wars and for profits. So that's part of the message of my campaign. And it's also a message of saying that, you know, we have to declare that capitalism is unacceptable for the sake of future generations. And the fact is that it's unacceptable here, it's unacceptable everywhere, and you don't have to accept the unacceptable. Whether it's in the voting booth or on your block, you don't have to enable the enablers. You can instead choose to build a movement to build real systemic change. I ran in 2016, for Senate, U.S. Senate, and I got 36,000 votes. Now, a lot of the message got out to a lot of people, and undoubtedly, some of those people became activists. So that's why I'm running, to create more activists. That's what's the important part about it, because that's what creates real change. And you know, whether we're talking about we need to get more folks like who think like Karl Marx, who think like Lenin, who think like Mao, who think like Rosa Luxemburg, who think like Amilcar Cabral, Che, Fidel, Harriet Tubman, Krupskaya, Leila Khalid, Lucy Parsons, Patrice Lumumba, and many, many more, who said emphatically over and over again in word and deed that this system of exploitation, oppression, war, and poverty must end. Thank you.
So we did invite all of the candidates that are running for U.S. Senate here in California. It looks like Dianne Feinstein is absent for the North State today. Kevin DeLeon is also absent today, as well as Allison Hartson and John Melendez. So for those of you who showed up to the North State, we thank you and welcome to Chico. Candidates, this will be the first of two lightning rounds. You'll be asked a yes or no question. Each candidate will have an opportunity to answer. Please answer only yes or no, and we do have three mics, for one for each of you. I think the last one's on that chair over there. First question, do you support net neutrality?
Yes.
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 Question two, will you take corporate PAC money?
No.
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 Do you support removing cannabis from the list of Schedule I narcotics?
Yes.
I think yes. I'm having a hard time hearing. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Let me sit over there. It's that echo. Switch mics. Echo and age. Yes.
That was a yes.
Do you support Black Lives Matter movement?
Yes.
Black yes.
Say it again.
Black Lives Matter. Do you support?
Oh,
Black Lives Matter?
Of course. Yes.
Do you think native treaties should be superseded state powers of eminent domain?
Yes.
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 Last question. Do you support Medicare for all?
Yes. Yes.
Of course.
All right, folks, now we're going to go into the round one moderator questions. Each question will be directed towards one candidate who will have 3 minutes to answer. The remaining candidates will have 1 minute to follow up. To the passionate audience members out there, we do want to let you know that we have a limited amount of time and we won't be able to hit all of the subjects that are important to you, but we will have a round of audience questions later on, so please save your questions for that time. This question's from me. Last year, the double spillway failure at Reservoir Oroville threatened the lives of my family and 200,000 others downstream. Butte County is now suing DWR. How will you use the power of the U.S. Senate seat to protect the lives of those living downstream from our aging infrastructure?
A lot of the problems can be solved. Like we said, there's a $700 billion military budget. And you know, Forbes magazine did a study. It's estimated that by 2053, you and I are going to be paying $100,000 each for this military that does what? Nothing for us. So much of the money, in fact, we're living in a great time right now, a time where productive capacity, we can produce all the food, all of the housing, all of the health care for the entire world. In fact, they said it's $175 billion was all it would take to end severe poverty around the world, $175 billion. So the aging infrastructure is decaying because it's more profitable to invest in the military than it is to invest in infrastructure, because we don't have a choice. We don't own the means of production, so we can't make those choices. The ruling class does. But that's a simple way to invest in jobs, to create our infrastructure, help repair our bridges, and they're labor intensive as well. So that would be my solution, is to stop the U.S. wars and proxy wars and use that money for our needs.
Thank you. Y'all have one minute each to respond, yes.
Okay, thank you. Actually, I agree with a lot of what he just said, that the military budget needs to be cut drastically in order to help shore up infrastructure. But we also need to look at other solutions in terms of how to shore up our infrastructure and how to assure safety, including, first of all, who benefits most from infrastructure in terms of transportation, in terms of business? large corporations. They need to be paying their fair share of taxes. What we saw in this tax cut is we saw them get basically a free ride, get their taxes cut dramatically. Instead, what we need to be doing is we need to be seeing that they pay their fair share of taxes so that the money can also go into shoring up infrastructure and for things like the Oroville Dam. But also, we are looking at an enormous push to build more dams in environmentally unsound areas where it could cause huge, huge issues. We need to be testing what we need to do in order to get and save water to make these environmentally safe. We have got to make sure, however, that the money is there to be able to pay for this. And as he said, defense spending, cut corporate taxes, and tax the wealthy, top 1%.
So the other candidates touched on the same issue that I'm going to say. I'll wait for the thing. Are we good? Okay, so I touched on the same thing I'm going to say, but I'm going to cut right to the chase. Every single issue you see in our system that's broken is backed. You back up into that issue, and you look to see the problem, and it's not that we don't have a solution. We have a solution for everything. We have an issue with corporate donations going into politics and basically shutting off any public opinion towards that issue. So the Oroville Dam, crumbling freeways, bridges, all these issues that we have, those aren't getting addressed. Because as was mentioned earlier, we'd rather spend money on more profitable things like war. So I'm for ending the military-industrial complex. Yes, we can use a lot of that money, that $700 billion that we gave away, that Democrats helped give away to Trump, and we can use that for infrastructure. But there's a lot of other ways to make money, to raise money for this, and not all of them are the status quo opinions that you will see through cutting taxes or raising taxes or any of that.
All right, so here's my question. The news organization Truth Out cites increased detention rate of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. is primarily caused by a cyclical process occurring between the three main actors: government agencies, private prison corporations, and Congress. If you're elected, what would you do to address this issue?
Well, in 2013, I think it was, I wrote and authored a ballot initiative, the $15 minimum wage ballot initiative. In fact, it's what got in Los Angeles Mayor Garcetti going and proposing the other initiatives. And in that initiative, I wrote that the problem with the exploitation of workers who are in detention centers. More and more people are in detention centers, and they're getting paid sometimes $1 a day, sometimes nothing for work. That's going on today in these privatized areas, but also in the public detention centers. So that bill addressed that issue, but it was also addressing the issue to bring light on the fact of this newfound slavery. And just like the prison industrial complex affected under the Clinton administration when he started privatizing prisons and the three strike laws came about, it was very, very profitable for the privatized prison industry. And it's a profit motive that encourages more and more people to be sent to these detention centers and prisons. And so we have to highlight that as well. So that's about it.
How much time? 2 minutes? Okay, thank you. This is an issue that's very near and dear to my heart. I have been a criminal defense attorney, as I said, for the last 25 years, and a civil rights attorney. I am extraordinarily familiar with the privatization of prisons, what we have seen in terms of not only the way the criminal justice system has treated undocumented immigrants, but also the way it's treated different racial minorities. It is not something that I talk about or just say, I'm going to go fight it. I've been doing it. I know exactly what it's like to go into a privatized prison because I've been there. I've seen what they do. I've seen how, for example, they cut costs by trying to feed somebody a bologna sandwich. Thank you. By feeding somebody a bologna sandwich in order to cut costs. I've seen what they do. I know that privatized prisons need to be eliminated, and they need to be eliminated now. We need, not only in terms of the immigration system, what we've seen is we have seen ICE decide that, and through the Trump administration, decide that essentially They can go into any police department anywhere, start taking people out of jail that have holes on them, instead of, which is the old way, which is the way I grew up through the system, of the person being released and then going through the system so that they don't have to be in prison for it. We are seeing a revolution in the criminal justice system. We need major criminal justice reform. We need to understand that it not only applies just to racial minorities, it applies to everyone across this country, because the criminal justice system is broken. I've seen it up close. It is broken. And I tell people one thing that you have to be we have to be very, very clear on. Not only do we need to get rid of privatized prisons, but we need to learn to teach our police departments to de-escalate when they go into situations. There needs to be de-escalations instead of pulling the weapons, instead of shooting first and thinking later. This is a major, major problem, and it's something that the police departments across the country are starting to pick up on. It needs to be pushed. We absolutely need to see major criminal justice reform in this country, and I believe I'm the person who can best do that because I'm the person who understands it, who's been living it and been doing it for the last 25 years.
Oh, it's 2 minutes. Well, I'm going to go on forever then. If you look at my flyers that I have out on my table, it says end mass incarceration, which is a great tagline, and it also says decriminalize cannabis. So those are twofold. So the reasons why I put both on there is because one begets the other. So we have people in jail in other states, because thankfully we decriminalized here in California, in other states, in federal prison, for smoking a joint, for possession, and whatnot. They can stay there for several years, a decade, for having pot in their possession. What I want to do is decriminalize marijuana altogether on the federal level. And I take it a step further and I say, let's decriminalize the use of all other drugs. And what does that mean? That means we don't throw people in prison because they're addicts. We put them in rehabilitation programs. We don't need to keep this cycle going. No one has gone to prison and ended their addiction. Now, once we release all the people that we just legalized because their crimes are no longer crimes, and they go back out on the street and back to their families, and they try to get a job, they can't get a job because they have a prior conviction. So we're going to retroactively expunge their records at no cost to them. I'm for tuition-free college and trade schools. So guess what? When you go to an apprenticeship program with the Carpenters Union or any other union like that, and you have drugs in your system or have a previous criminal record, they might not take you into that program. But if we have a statewide or federal system for trade schools through community colleges, then those people can get jobs because they don't have any prerequisites that say you can't have drugs in your system, like if you're smoking pot in a state where it's not legal, or even here, they still tag people for that, or if you have a previous conviction because it hasn't been expunged in a state where they haven't done that, then those people can still get educated in a skilled trade labor and still go to work. So this is a bigger issue than just one thing. I'm, of course, for banning private prisons. And when Stephon Clark got shot in the back by police in our community in Sacramento, I was in the streets. I was one of the people shutting down the stadium. So this is what we need to come out and be a spokesperson for these innocent people who are shot.
Gentlemen, what solutions do you have to the statewide homelessness crisis, and what is the ultimate goal of your solutions? Specifically, what will you do to mitigate income inequality?
Any solutions that we're talking about to any of these problems, they also have to figure out a way to, they have to help take away the grip on the means of production that the ruling class has. Otherwise, it's kind of folly and counterproductive, whether we're talking about half-baked ideas about co-ops or kindler, gentler capitalism. Whatever the solution is, it has to help empower and educate our class as to the need to break with this system and to break with the enablers of the system, because we have to start talking about how are we going to stop these factories from laying off our family members. I mean, that's a big income cut right there. How are we going to stop these apartments from evicting our neighbors for the more lucrative hipsters? Or how are we going to stop these schools who refuse to teach Chicano or Native American or African American studies? And how are we going to stop these police departments, these
these dens of vipers of white supremacy that have, like we said before, Stefan Klock, Taisha Miller, all the Latinx and Native people who have been killed. That's one of the things we have to always, with all the solutions we're talking about. And in terms of income, the problems with creating more income cannot be solved within the context of this mode of production of capitalism. Trump talked about trying to help get more steel jobs by having a tariff on foreign steel. And that's not going to work. It's just going to, the production costs over here are going to be higher and the demand is going to be lower and unemployment is going to be higher. Bush Jr. tried that in for 13 months and 200,000 jobs were lost. The 60,000 jobs, steel jobs that were lost since 2010 were not lost because of foreign competition. They were lost because of the way steel is being produced with advanced technology, which creates machines that cut the workers. See, the capitalists don't care about employing workers. What they're trying to do is maximize profits. The only way they can do that is to cut workers and use machines to replace them.
I think it's a two-part question. The first part about homelessness, one of the things that we have to recognize is we have to look at the reasons for homelessness, and there are a number of them, but first and foremost, one of the largest causes of homelessness is health care in this country. It's caused not only through mental illness, but also just generally people who cannot afford and who go bankrupt because of their inability to pay for health care or they attempt to pay for health care. So number one, I believe very strongly in Medicare for All, because we have to make sure that everybody has a right to health care. That's going to help cure a great deal, including in Medicare for All, is help for mental illness. Secondly, as far as homelessness, you know, one of the things that's frustrating is in this state is that the state legislature has passed several billion dollars to help in terms of building affordable housing. In Los Angeles County, the city council there has passed legislation for several hundred million dollars, and you find throughout the state this is occurring in different locations, and it's not being spent. It is tied up. It is being absolutely kept, largely partly because of real estate development and real estate developers, but it is being kept from actually being spent. We passed a proposition to allow for more additional money for homelessness. Not one penny of it has gone to homelessness. So that is a huge problem and something that we need to push. Income inequality, I would say this. We obviously need a $15 minimum wage to begin with. That's a start, but it's just a start. We need to do things for people in the lower middle class, like a higher income tax credit. We need to be able to make sure that people who have a job get a livable wage. We can't have people working two and three jobs just to pay their bills and then expect that these people are going to be able to do other things, putting their kids through college, those kind of things. We have to pay a livable wage. It is the essence of this country. And in order to do that, we need the reemergence of labor unions in this country. And we need to be pushing for labor unions because that's the way it got done in the first place. That's the way it's going to get done again, I believe.
All right, so I'll answer all the questions that were asked, homelessness, and the issues that were brought up with mental health and housing all at once. Single-payer health care. You have tuition-free colleges and trade schools, like I mentioned before, which will bring education up among the poorer classes, which included me until recently. And then you have wages that actually make sense. So $15 minimum wage, that's great if you live in rural Alabama. Or live even in rural California in some areas. But what if you live in San Francisco? What if you live in LA? That's not enough. So what we're going to do is take that and increase that minimum wage to the cost of living to that area. So what we're going to have is a graph of minimum wages that starts at $15 an hour and goes up depending on the cost of living in that area. But that's not enough, because you know what's going to happen when they raise our wages? Oh, we got to find money somewhere, so we're going to cut into, or we're going to raise prices on consumer products. Guess who's the consumer? You and me. So we're going to get our nice fat paycheck and go to the store and spend all that money and say, where did all my paycheck go? Where did my raise go? Well, they just raised all the prices on us. So we're going to tack all of those minimum wages on that graph to the consumer price index, so when the corporations raise their prices, our wages follow. So that's how we get rid of income inequality, those three issues, homelessness specifically. I work with Steven Seeger. He was living in Santa Rosa when the fires hit. We talked for a while about mental health. 4% of the mental health community, the homeless community, needs permanent care. And they need beds. We need funding for those beds. So the only way we can get people off the streets and in permanent care is to solve that crisis by having funding for those beds on the federal level. So that's what I'm pushing. We're calling it the Phoenix Program because his house almost burned down in the fires in Santa Rosa. You could point across the street and down the way a little bit to the fire line, and you look at it on the map, and it's just like a flood of fire came that close to his house. So that's why we named it that. But I'm working with him on that, and we're going to go and push that program farther, whether or not this election turns out in our favor.
The next question is on campaign finance reform, and we'll start with Pat. A solution to keeping big money interests out of politics is to build small donor bases, which limits big donor influence. Talk about your position on campaign finance reform.
It is the issue of our generation. It is the single most important issue because it goes to every other issue that we deal with, whether it be health care, whether it be the environment, whether it be criminal justice. Campaign finance reform goes to the heart of everything. We have to make sure that our candidates are corporate free in the Democratic Party. We have to. The Democratic Party decided back in the 1990s that the solution to getting back into office was to go to Wall Street. We're going to go get money from Wall Street, just like the Republicans do. Great solution, right? We're here, sit here in 2018. Because that's how we're going to win. We're going to get that money from Wall Street. We're going to win. We're sitting here in 2018. We've lost the White House, the Senate, the Congress, governorships, state legislatures. We're not winning. And the reason we're not winning is because we've given up the very principle of the Democratic Party that we are the party of working men and women, and instead we've gone to Wall Street. That's the essential problem here. Campaign finance reform has got to be the number one issue for anybody running for office these days. There are four potential solutions as far as campaign finance. I'm going to hit on the first one because I know I don't have a whole lot of time. Public financing of elections is the way to go. This is the future in this country. Not only is it going to allow people who are pretty much, you know, doctors, nurses, police officers, teachers, no matter what area of life you come from, you're going to be able to run for office if you can go through public financing. The other thing solutions are, we have to get rid of Citizens United. There's no question. We've got a Supreme Court that unfortunately is going to be difficult to do that with. So what we've got to do is what the Republicans did with Roe v. Wade. I saw as a lawyer for 40 years, they've chipped away at it. Every year, they've chipped away at Roe v. Wade, constantly passing, pushing legislation, doing things in court cases to stop, to cut back on Roe v. Wade. We need to be doing the same thing with Citizens United while we're trying to do it. Third thing, very quickly, we also need to be looking at a group called Represent Us. It's a great organization. If you get a chance, look them up on the internet. It's a group that believes in ballot measures pushing up from the bottom to get campaign finance reform. But it is the single most important issue of the day. Thank you.
Well, number one, I think we have to be honest about what this system is and who is in control of this system. Since the 1800s, the money that the Mellons and the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts got from, you know, Manhattan Bank, became Chase Manhattan Bank, and U.S. Steel from J.P. Morgan, and the railroads from the Vanderbilts, all those things came from slavery and cotton production. They had such an immense amount of wealth that the ruling class was able to, since the late 1800s, whoever they financed, whether it be Democrat or Republican, whoever the majority of the money got, received the majority won, they're the ones who won. It's been rigged since the 1800s, since after Reconstruction, and that's the reality. And when it doesn't go the way they want it to go, they can use the Electoral College like they did to repeal Reconstruction with the Electoral College. So the real problem is, how do we get the power to force them to do something? And if you want a solution to that, we can look. There's some great solutions that are going on right now. In the West Virginia teachers had a strike. It was led by women, rank and file women strike, that not only gave them higher wages,
it gave higher wages for the entire state, and it was an illegal strike. They broke the law, and they did it, and the Democratic Party and the union leadership told them not to do it, but they stayed on strike and they won. And you know what? Militance is contagious, because in Oklahoma and Kentucky and Arizona, they followed suit. Now compare that to in 2011, when the occupied the capital of Wisconsin was occupied. And it was a courageous occupation, but the Democratic Party and the leadership of the unions had told them, persuaded them, stop your occupation and don't you dare go on a statewide strike. Well, they lost. So it shows, if we want to have power, we have to have independent movements. I was in Los Angeles during the 2006 migrant uprisings. I was part of the boycott. And you know, that one day of boycott, they lost hundreds of millions of dollars. If we withhold our labor power and unite, we have the power to do whatever we need to do.
So there's several obvious answers. In Citizens United, we can do that in a few different ways. We can do that, I won't get into the ways because that'll eat into my 2 minutes. But we can do that, get rid of Citizens United. We can do publicly funded elections, which will force us to pass a bill through the legislature. But there's a bigger issue. There's self-funded candidates like Dianne Feinstein who gave $5 million to her own campaign. Loaned $5 million to her own campaign. So I was like, okay, well, I got to go against Feinstein, so I'm going to go to my bank account and grab $5 million. Oh, wait, there's nothing there. So I can't do that. So if we want to fight corporate candidates and wealthy candidates, yes, we need to change the system altogether. But there's a bigger issue underneath all of this that hasn't been mentioned. And that's come more clear to me today and over the last week, is we are too divided to make change. We're talking about, look at the Republicans, look at the Democrats. The Green Party's saying, look at the Democrats, they're evil and corporate. The Democratic Party, look at the Greens, they can't do anything right. Peace and Freedom, who are they? Independent candidates, let's just forget about them. No, that's not the way this works. I would rather ally with a Republican to get corporate money out of politics, then go and slit each other's throats because we're in a different party. That's a gang mentality that we need to get rid of. If we're going to unite on the left and be corporate free, we need to include everybody. That doesn't just mean Democrats. That doesn't just mean Greens. That doesn't just mean independents or peace and freedom. Everybody who is interested in getting corporate money out of politics, unifying our power, that's what we need to do. Yes, we need to march in the street. Yes, we need to Citizens United and change the laws. But how are we going to do that where we're in silos and we're not even talking to each other? People attack me for running Democrat. If you knew me and knew what I said about the Democrat, just jump on Twitter. That'll shorten that real quick. I've had people from the Democratic Party attack me for what I've said about them because it's true. So we need to unite. We need to get everyone together. It's not about party.
All right, folks, we're going to head into our second lightning round. Diane has our first question over here.
Ranked choice voting is used in single seat elections with more than two candidates. It helps select a candidate that better reflects the support of the majority of voters and opens up the voting process so that voters can vote their conscience. Would you support ranked choice voting?
Yes.
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 When I envision a future for my generation, I want to see people who are connected to their land. The local farmers market here in Chico is an exemplary case study of just that. Do you support breaking up corporate industrial agriculture to small family farms as the original Reclamation Act of 1902 intended?
Yes.
Police officers across the U.S. shot and killed 987 people last year. Do you support civilian oversight and demilitarization of police?
Yes.
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 This is a big one for me. I really want to know. Do you support water transfers south of the Delta?
Water transfers in
We're looking
terms
at the twin tunnels.
No. Absolutely not.
Bless you, gentlemen. Butte County Behavioral Health Director Dorian Kittrell said the number one issue in Butte County facing the mental health community is poverty and homelessness. Will you act on mental health and homelessness?
Yes.
So we're going to break out first, just so in the interest of time, we want to make sure that the folks who are out here in the audience who showed up today get their questions answered. We're going to take 20 minutes to do an audience question and answer. And Allie will be bringing the mic around. So if you want to ask a question, please come line up right here along this aisle.
All right, first question. What do you got? Your name?
My name is Matthew Hilliard. I'm from Siskiyou County. I'm here with my father, Bob Hilliard. We live almost in Oregon, but fully and proudly in California. Siskiyou County are lands that were ancestral territory of the Wintu, Shasta, Pitt River tribes, and are the current territory of the Quartz Creek and Karuk people. My question is about dams. The Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement was an example of ordinary people doing everything right. For nearly a decade, individual citizens showed extraordinary courage. Farmers and ranchers agreed to consume less water, even though harvests would decrease. Indigenous tribes and others agreed to divert some water to the ranchers, even though salmon revival might be decreased. All in all, 34 vastly different groups came together, compromised, and hashed out their differences. But in one single day, two congressmen, Greg Walden of Oregon and Doug Lamoff of California, nixed 10 years of work. My question is, how do people in conservative areas like ours that get shaded by the Republican orthodoxy and also get shaded by Democrats not showing up, how do we get represented? Thank you.
Wow, thank you.
Do David first.
How do you get people to show up is you put a lot of immense pressure on them. That's number one. You get out in the streets and you actually actively pressure them. Step two is when that doesn't work, and it usually doesn't. You elect people into those offices that aren't steered by corporations. When it comes to raising dams and building tunnels, I'm against both, and the reason why is because we don't need it. We don't have a water problem in California. That's going to be on the news tomorrow. No, the news ignores me. We need to reclaim and recycle the water where it's needed. If LA needs a ton of water, recycle the water in your city and reuse it. This problem solved. You don't have to, from up here, you don't have to say, well, they're watering their lawns with our water. And down there, they can't say, we have the population down here. You have the water up there. We need it. The problem's over. There's no political split in it.
I think to answer your first question, how do we get people to actually turn out? You got to stand for something. The problem is that if you basically just continue to be what we are, which is a party that's wishy-washy, a party that doesn't have a backbone, a party that doesn't stand up, then people don't want to come out and support you. You got to have a program. Our program cannot be, we are anti-Donald Trump. That is not an agenda. An agenda cannot be, we are going to take this country back. It's got to be, we are moving this country forward. If we put together a real plan with real ideas, innovative, imaginative, the things we used to do in this country that made this country the greatest middle class in the world, if we go back to doing that and putting together new imaginative programs, people will come out for that. They're not going to come out if you're just one slight version over from the other party. There's got to be an agenda. There's got to be a plan. That's what we got to do to get people to turn out. We got to stand for something. We got to actually mean what we say. As far as the water issue directly, and I think David addressed it, I agree with him. You know, in Los Angeles, when we had the drought in for 4 years, essentially it was. There were all these people, you know, saying, okay, you got to take shorter showers. You got to quit watering the lawns. You got to quit doing this and this. And people did, exactly like you mentioned in your question. People did. You ask them how to do something, willingness, you explain to them, this is why we're doing it, they do it. We don't need the Delta tunnels. LA doesn't need the Delta tunnels. There's no reason for them, because if you actually just ask people to conserve and, as you said, recycle the water, That's enough. It's sufficient. So that's what I believe we need to do. But I go back to get people to turn out, stand for something.
Testing. So, yeah, there's a couple of things. You know, one is these politicians, of course, they don't respect self-determination of Native peoples and anyone else. Only thing they respect is the dollars that sponsored them, that got them into office, and that's what their decisions are based on. And that's it. If you, in order to get into that office, Dianne Feinstein spending $10 million or more. I'm spending $4,000, but you need that money to get an office, and that money comes with strings. So, again, it's going to take people's power, and any politician that's worth their salt, a real politician who really cares about things, would spend most of their time trying to build a grassroots movement. If I was in office, I'd try to build a grassroots movement to occupy the White House, and because that occupation, that holding back, reserving the power of labor, holding back their money, because actually it's workers who create all the wealth. So we have a lot of power. It just has to be assisted by the politicians as well. And I mean, these problems we have are there's some obvious things going on, like war. 8 million people are expected to starve in Yemen directly as a result of the US war in cooperation with Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's an obvious, that's genocide, that's a Holocaust, and why isn't anything being done about it? Because they're not allowed to do anything because they're in the confines of the ruling class. So if we want to do something about that issue or any other issue, we should be encouraging folks to act up. If you got to do something that's illegal, then we should be supporting you and saying that what's really illegal is this system of exploitation.
Hi, my name's David Phillips, and I'm focusing on something a little more serious, and that's the police killings in Butte County, the corruption in Butte County, the stereotyping, the harassment of the homeless. I seen my son murdered by Chico PD. There was a young lady that was just murdered 2 days ago. 30 years, 30 police killings, all justified. So how are you guys gonna address that? Not just sitting here saying this, oh, so you wanna get in office. Are you gonna actually do something about this? You can go leave here, go back to whatever you're doing, and be right there with the DA. Be right there with the chief of police. Yeah, turn your head, David. I'm talking to all of you. How are you guys gonna address that? The killings, the police cover-ups, the corruption, the stereotyping. That's what I need to know.
And gentlemen, we'll try to keep your answers short in the interest of time. We have 13 minutes. Go ahead.
Well, number one, we got to understand what's the motivation behind these police killings, why it keeps going on, and why everybody keeps letting it go on. Like I said, we're in a crisis of overproduction, a global crisis of overproduction. The only way that the banks and corporations can make money now, the primary ways, is through austerity. Austerity taking away your Social Security benefits, your pensions, the school, food stamps, all those kinds of things. But when you do that, communities are going to have an uprising. They're going to fight back. So you need to have, if you're the ruling class, you need to have repression to keep people from wanting to fight for justice. And that's what this police brutality is. It's nationwide. It's going on every day. Every day, black and brown people are, I feel you, brother. Every day, black and brown people are being killed in the streets. I have a 20-year-old son. He's 6'5". And the police see him, they see a monster. I've been worried. I live in South Central. I'm worried every day whether the police are going to kill him. And it's happening over and over. When I ran in 2016, Kamala Harris was running. And Kamala Harris was the attorney general and refused to make these prosecutors prosecute these killer cops. It's so obvious. They think you see it on the video. Why is it continuing to go on? Because the politicians aren't allowed to touch that issue. But we have to do what we have to do. Our children are dying in the streets. You know, it's like somebody's, you see them in the middle of the street, they're
bleeding out, and the politicians are talking about, well, maybe we'll get them new shoes. No, the problem is there's a murder going on right now, and we got to call it murder. And these cops should be in jail. These cops should be the chief of police, whoever is enabling these folks should all be thrown in jail, you know, right away, and accused of what they are. They're killing our youth, and it's a crisis. And that's why it's one of the first demands on mine. Is this, and the proposal is to stop the use of deadly force, especially in black and brown communities, and declare it a crisis, an emergency crisis, a state of emergency, I say. That's why I put that in the platform, because it is a crisis, and nobody's saying anything about it because they're worried about offending their corporate sponsors. But no. We got to take it serious. Just as serious as you're taking it, we got to take it that serious.
It is a crisis, and let me just tell you a quick story, because in Los Angeles, 2 weeks ago, well, it started 2 years ago, a young black man in Venice, about 30 years old, was gunned down in the street by a police officer. The police officer who was with him, his partner, refused to back up his story. The videotape refused to back up his story. The police commission came back and said it was a shooting outside of policy. The chief of police in Los Angeles said his police officer should be prosecuted. 2 weeks ago, the district attorney declined to prosecute the police officer. The chief of police said he should have been prosecuted, and she did. You ask what I'm going to do? First of all, we started a movement 2 weeks ago to have her removed. Immediately, as the district attorney, asking to resign because she hadn't got the guts to go on a case like that. She doesn't need to be the DA. Third, a whole group of civil rights attorneys like myself have gathered together. We're going to find a criminal defense and civil rights attorney to run for DA, to go take over that office, just like it's happened in Philadelphia, it's like it's happened in San Antonio, like it's happened hopefully in Oakland and San Diego. We're going to get a criminal defense and civil rights attorney in the DA's office, somebody who knows how the system works and how to fix this, because that's the only way it's going to get fixed. That's what I've been doing with my life, though. For 25 years, I've defended. I have gone in and sued those police officers. I fought the police department. That's what I've been doing. I have a record of it. So it's not just coming here and talking and then going out and do something. That's what I've been doing. And one final thing. I think I got a little bit of time. I talk about the cowardice sometimes of the Democratic Party. 50% of the Democratic Party will not utter the phrase Black Lives Matter. This is a party that has been built on the voting habits of the African-American community, specifically African-American women and African-American men, and don't have the guts to get out and say Black Lives Matter. That's the problem we have when I say there's a lack of courage.
So I'll start off with Black Lives Matter, and I'll start off with Stephon Clark. So I mentioned earlier that I went out and shut down the stadium with protesters for Stephon Clark. It wasn't just a one-issue thing. I went out 7 times for Stephon Clark. So we don't need to wait for DAs to run to replace the current ones, because in Sacramento we have one running. We also have a sheriff to replace Scott Jones. So the current DA and the current sheriff are extremely corrupt. The current DA, Marianne Schubert, accepted quite a few $1,000s from the police association, and suddenly the cops are still not getting prosecuted for what they have done. 8 shots, 7 in the back for holding a cell phone in my backyard. We walked past the house on that night. So what needs to happen? Obviously, police reforms. I can talk to that till I'm blue in the face. The reality on the federal level is we got a lot of work to do. The reality on the state level is we still got a lot of work to do. But the work is going to be done on the local level. Pamela Price in Alameda County, she's running for DA there. First black woman running for DA. What's that going to change? A lot. I think she said in her speech last night, it's been the last 50 years that they've just handed the DA slot down within the department, within the city. No outsiders come in, no one challenges. She is the first challenger. So if you want change, you elect people who want that change. You elect people like Noah Phillips, like I mentioned, in Sacramento, and Pamela Price for DA. You elect Milo Fitch for sheriff of Sacramento County. Those are issues that we're involved with now. When I first heard Noah's speech, I was like, I don't know, this guy might be more of the same. I heard his speech, I saw who was backing him. Okay, I'll give this guy a chance. Heard him speak, endorsed him. He is not afraid to go right up, and it's his boss that he's running against, and say what needs to be said. That takes courage in the spine, and that's the kind of people I have faith in. Those are the people who are going to change. But this is an issue that we need to start on the local level, and that's the most power we have, replacing DAs and sheriffs, especially sheriffs like Scott Jones.
All right, folks. We have prepared a couple more moderator questions, but we have a huge line for audience questions. What would you prefer? That's what I thought. Okay. Well, we're going to, just so that we can hit everybody, we're going to time the responses to 2 minutes, okay?
I'll try to keep the question short. You all seem to support Medicare for All, which I do, or some other form of universal health coverage. The problem is that healthcare right now eats up 18% of our economy. It's a big burden on the backs of all Americans, even if they don't recognize it, including the debt that's accumulating at the federal level. So my question to you is, how would you transition to a healthcare for all, whether it's Medicare for all or some other form of universal coverage? How would you actually do that transition?
I think in order to pay for it, I do believe that there is no question in this country at this point that Medicare for All is something that people are realizing it's the wave of the future. It's going to happen. The question is, when is it going to happen and how is it going to be paid for? And you're asking the second question. Four things need to happen. First off, we need to be taxing stock sales and bond sales, okay? It's the one thing I disagree with Bernie Sanders on. I think he had a proposal of taxing stock sales at 3% and bond sales at 5%. I think it ought to be 5 and 7%, or 0.5 and 0.7%. So I disagree with him on that, but because I think it actually ought to be more. Secondly, we have to cut Defense Department spending. I don't think there's any question. We've all talked about that. And part of the defense spending budget needs to be taken and applied to a Medicare for All program. Thirdly, I think we tax the businesses at about a 3.5%, which at this point would be more than what they're paying, but in the long run, they're going to end up saving money for their employees and what they put into the base. Thank you. Fourthly, I think what every person has to do in this country is recognize that a Medicare for All system is not only good for themselves, it's good for their neighbors. And ultimately, when it comes down to it, we are our brother's keeper. We are. And we have to make sure that everyone, including our neighbors, is taken care of. That means paying our fair share of taxes, too. And if it means paying taxes, they're a little higher so that not only is our family taken care of in our time of need health care, but our neighbors are taken care of in there. That's something we need to do. We certainly need to increase it on the 1% in order to get them to pay their fair share. But all of us need to pay a little bit more because in the end, what Medicare for All does, and this is, I think, the most misunderstood thing, it includes preventive medicine. It's not just taking care of now. It includes preventive medicine, and preventive medicine will eventually actually save money for all of us, including the taxpayers as well. I think that's the four ways you pay for it.
A big problem with the cost is it's not a real, it doesn't have to be that cost. The reason that's the cost is because we have a privatized medical industry. So the pharmaceutical companies can charge whatever they want for things, and so that's one of the, where the main costs are coming from, because it's privatized. But like I said before, you know, you can easily get all of the money needed for this, for the health care, from the military budget. But also, you know, the people might say, well, you don't want to make the healthcare single payer, you don't want to have all this and all that. Okay, let's leave it up to the people, not to the politicians. Let's have a referendum, because on my platform let's have a referendum on vital industries. Let the people decide whether these private industries, should they remain private or should they be public? and we can use those resources. Let the people decide that kind of thing. And when it comes to taking money, you can get you can cut the defense budget, you'll get a little bit of money there. We need to stop all U.S. wars. Honest politicians have to say they're going to stop all U.S. wars and proxy wars that are going on right now in Syria. All of these wars. What do these wars do? The refugee crisis that we have right now, there's a worldwide refugee crisis precisely because of the war in Iraq, the war in Syria, and the war in Libya. The U.S. wars that created this refugee, I don't know how many children are dying at sea or are dying in refugee camps. They're very serious. So anyone who cares about humanity, not only to get the money that we'll be able to use for housing and health care, but also to stop the bloodletting of our sisters and brothers and others overseas. So that's where we can get the solution. And let's have a referendum. Let the people decide. If this is really a democracy, let the people decide whether they want Standard Oil or whether they want these Exxon to decide our fate, or should we decide our fate?
Commend him on his timing. Right on the dot. So I believe the question was, how would we implement and basically how would we pay for it? And I want to say right up front, single payer does not cost more than what we have. It costs less. And here's the reason why. You do a simple math equation, right? You have private for-profit insurance companies. So you got their total fund here. You take out advertising, that takes it down a little bit. You take out corporate shareholder profits, that takes it way down. They're cut out of the picture completely. So will we have to advertise single payer? Yeah, for a month or two after we implement it, but then we're done. No advertisement costs. Everyone's automatically enrolled. We just have to let people know how it's done. So it doesn't cost more, it costs less. Here in California, it costs $37 billion less to pass a single payer program. That's the funding that the state legislature says doesn't exist. That does exist in two studies. We could do that through a tax on payroll, so we'd pay it the same exact way we currently pay for healthcare. That might not cover it all, and we might have to go into other solutions, which are all in these studies that I could go on for a while about. I've supported single payer for 10 years. I support single payer because it's cheaper. I support single payer because when the other side says, we're not going to allow non-citizens onto the rolls of single payer if we pass it, I say, no, yes, you are, because you're still paying less. Where do they go now? ER. So now we have overcrowded ER rooms at 5 times the cost of a regular doctor. We're already paying for that. I debated somebody from the state of Jefferson at the state capitol because they had 2 different rallies going on, the March for Science tax march on one side, and then around the corner they had the state of Jefferson and gun rights groups on the other side. So a couple of them came over and saw my single payer sign on the table. And they said, how are you going to pay for it? I debated them to the point that not only did they agree that single payer was a good idea, but they agreed to having undocumented immigrants in the single payer system. It takes a debate. And as for a referendum, the polls are out. Nationwide, I think it's 51-52% want single payer.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Robert Brown. I'm a member leader of SEIU Local 2015. We represent over 375,000 healthcare workers across the state of California. Currently, the right of unions to organize is under attack, both through court cases and by statutes that are promoting the right to work state. What will you do about that? We need more home healthcare workers. Our baby boomer population is retiring. And as the baby boomers retire, we're going to need to increase our membership from 375 to over 700,000 members just to take care of people. We have to be able to organize to do that. What will you do to help us?
David.
Great. So we got a lot on the table coming up. We have the Janus case, we have the California rule case. I won't get into the details on either of those, but I'm sure you're aware of it. Janus case basically undercuts the funding for unions. It's basically right to work on the nationwide level. California rule attacks state worker pensions, and that would happen everywhere, and it would probably apply, if passed, to the federal pension system as well, so any public pensions. So we're under attack. This is another issue where we need to hit the streets. And I'm not talking hit the streets and wave a sign one day and go home. I'm talking we need to have local strikes, we need to have statewide strikes, and we have to have national strikes. And this is something that's not going to happen. Yeah, so here's the issue. Is we got, like I said, a lot of stuff going against us. We need card check on the federal level, which basically that allows unions to organize. You just vote for a union and you get that card check. Mentioned the need of jobs when the baby boomers retire. There's plenty of people that want good paying jobs. Those people are willing to back unions because they want those good paying jobs. So if you offer them an actual wage and offer them a tuition-free trade school and college system, then they could get into that work. There's a lot of people that want those jobs. I know nurses personally. They work very hard, and they are very proud of what they do. And not only that, they're number one out in the front in the streets. So if we need wildcat strikes and whatnot to get the message out, that's something we need to do. Sometimes unions don't fight hard enough, so their members say, let's fight harder. That's something we need to do. But we need to unify. And unfortunately, as I mentioned on your show yesterday, as Americans, we like to sit down and wait until it gets so horrible that we have to hit the streets. We need to hit the streets now, before it gets that bad.
Pat?
Well, you're right. You can't strike in home health care. It's not something you can do. So striking doesn't work for that. In fact, what works for home health care, as you well know, anyone who has dealt in home health care, if you take a look at the regulation book, it'll probably come up to about your knees. The regulations are so overburdensome on home health care, and they are so impossible for anybody to follow, that what you're getting is you're getting the government coming in and basically trying to attack home health care when it should be, as you mentioned, it should be expanding because we have the baby boomers going into it. We should be facilitating it, making it easier, making it much more affordable, and making it something that can be done versus trying to cut back and stop it. I have seen home health care agencies that are trying to do the right thing, and you honestly, it's hard sometimes to even do the right thing when you're trying very hard because the regulations are so onerous on it. That has to do with home health care. But as far as unions, we have reached a point where the word union has become one of the great Republican conservative dirty words. It's one of the things they can throw out and make it sound like this is evil, like taxes, unions, those kind of things. We have got to establish the fact that unions, and go back to making people understand, when they talk about wanting a livable wage, when they talk about needing to be able to have the money to pay for their kids' educational thing, it's going to come through the rise of unions again. That's the solution. That's what got us out of the 50s and 60s and 70s and drove the largest middle class in the history of this country. It was the union movement. We have got to make sure and educate people this is the way. This is what we are going to have to do if we are going to bring this country back, because the unions are the ones. How is it? How do you think any negotiation, every person in here has negotiated something. How would you like to negotiate, go in negotiation, and only have one side get to negotiate? Well, that's what we have in most situations. We have to make it clear that unions are the strongest possibility for bringing the wages up, bringing countries back. We have to be able to push that.
Yeah, I'm probably one of the only politicians, probably if you call me a politician, that have actually brought union elections to a couple places I worked, one in New York and one in New Jersey. You could really see the difficulty of trying to get around these laws it's so hard to be able to unionize. So it would be much better to have an easier way to unionize our workers and get more union things. But these attacks, you know, in the first place, the Department of Labor needs to be run by labor. We really need union perks, folks like yourself, that are running the damn thing. And there should be, in the legislature, there should be a certain percentage of the legislature should be a section for workers in unions. Because the unions are, if you want to have democracy, you got to have a union. But, you know, if it was just about electing this one or electing that one and that would solve the problem, then you wouldn't see this
this is a constant systemic thing that's been going on for the last 40 or so years. Wages have been dropping and dropping, and union membership has been dropping. This is not just something that's going to happen, change with an election of somebody. It's a systemic problem. It's an attack against our class. And in order to fight that attack, well, I mean, the union's got a lot of power. We have and the folks who are really doing something about it are like those teachers. The Oklahoma teachers are the lowest paid teachers in the country, but they went out on strike like the West Virginia teachers. They're seeing that they have power. So instead of spending a lot of that money, that I know I work with folks from SEIU 721 a lot. Instead of spending a lot of that money to fund some Democratic politician, use that money to organize and occupy and do whatever you need to do and withhold your labor, and you watch them. You withhold the labor from the ruling class, the corporations. It's like withholding oxygen. They'll give you what they want. We just got to unite and build a community and union struggles together.
Hi, my name is Maura, and my question is, how are you going to deal with the gun violence that is in our country now?
Gun control.
Pat, go ahead.
What are your plans on addressing it? What are your plans?
There are lots, and have been for a long time now, in the last few years, a lot of good ideas and things we need to be talking about for gun control, gun safety. We need to be obviously talking about banning assault weapons. We need to be talking about banning bump stocks. I mean, there are a number of very good incremental things that we need to be doing, things that would push the debate and help us at least hopefully stop some of these mass murders. But that's not the root of the problem. We have to look at what the root of the problem is, and the root of the problem is the NRA. And the NRA's ability to bully Congress into doing whatever they want, despite the fact the vast majority of Americans don't want it. And it goes back to the same thing I was talking about earlier when I said the issue of our generation is corporate donations, because it's exactly, the NRA is a classic example of what happens when you allow a corporation or a group, in this case the NRA, to donate unlimited amount of funds to congressmen who then ignore their constituents' wishes, because they know, look, if the NRA gives me $50,000, I'll use that money for television advertising, and I'll convince the public that, you know, that I'm the greatest thing or my opponent's the worst thing ever. So they know that they can get the money and win re-election, so they don't care. All they want is the money. And again, it comes back to the NRA and donations. We want to solve gun control in this problem. We want real gun safety in this country. We got to cut the NRA off at the knees, and that's you do by corporate donations and ending corporate donations. Don't allow them to buy Congress. Don't allow them to go in there and make these kind of huge contributions. That will make a huge difference. That's how we're going to get this under control.
John?
So, you know, we have to have policies that make sense, that keep our communities safe. But I also have to tell you, gun control has to include these cops as well, because I don't feel safe walking around these cops when I see a gun. And I got a cell phone. I got a cell phone. It's black. I got to actually get a white one now because I'm really afraid. So what we really need to do is make sure our communities are safe. And it's a mental health issue as well. But one of the things that on my platform was to also abolish these police departments and create police departments from our communities. There are lots of folks that need jobs. There are lots of folks who could get training, get all the things we need, and we won't even need all of those lethal weapons that also, you know, they get in the police hands and they find their way into other people's hands as well. But we have to start looking about safety of our communities, and it's our community members who can keep us safe. So we don't need these police departments. We can create our own police departments with the proper training, with other things like that, but whatever control it is, it has to include the cops as well. That's it.
Gun control is an issue that's larger than gun control. So we obviously want an assault weapons ban. NRA is obviously acting as a terrorist organization. You can watch their videos and you can see that. No matter how they started off, that's where they're at now. But that's not the only issue. I'm going to throw a statistic out here. 60% of gun violence that's reported is mental health. 60% mental health suicide. So that drops back into single-payer health care. When everyone has coverage, everyone gets mental health coverage. So that takes care of 60%. Of those 60%, I believe it's 40%, are males, white males over the age of 45. So who's killing themselves with guns? The same group of people that's on the forefront for gun rights. They're killing themselves. So this is a huge issue. This is an issue of the soul, not just an issue that we can get fired up over. We can pass gun control issues, but we need to pass them as on the federal level, as we're running for, because we have had several shootings in California and Nevada, fully automatic weapons basically because of the bump stocks. When you can go to Nevada and buy basically whatever you want, even if it's illegal here in California, and literally drive an hour into California and commit a mass shooting, that's an issue. We need nationwide gun control, not just piecemeal, not just here and there. So yes, we can take California's laws and spread them across the nation. That's one way to solve it. But we need to cut that pipeline out. And when you have one state that has no gun laws, except for what's on the federal level, and you have another state that has very strict gun laws, that doesn't work. So we need mental health coverage. We need single-payer coverage. We need people to have hope in their lives. And that doesn't come from a Republican message. That doesn't come from a corporate Democratic message. That comes from a progressive, whatever party you are, or democratic socialist message of hope that includes something to allow people to go forward in their lives with education, with work, with a proper wage, and with protections in the workplace.
First of all, thanks you guys for coming to the greatest city in California. I want to ask you guys about a topic that maybe we can get some disagreement on, because it's a topic that divides progressives and has always baffled me. Progressives that agree on just about everything else, from climate change to wealth inequality to a hatred of Trump or whatever. But there's one issue that the Senate handles, and that's foreign treaties, I'm sure you're aware. And I wanted to know that if you were elected, would you continue to support the obscene amounts of financial aid that this country has for years given to Israel, and to enable the continued subjugation of the Palestinian people in the West Bank and Gaza? And how would your position differ from that of Senator Feinstein and your fellow Democrats who continue to support that policy?
Well, Feinstein, you know, she's changed her opinion now, but then she had said some very good things about Gina Haspel, you know, the person who was the director of the CIA appointed by Trump, who was in 2002 helped torture a bunch of folks and things like that, and then erase the evidence. So I understand why Feinstein says the things she does. She votes for every defense budget and all these things. I went to Gaza myself with a Viva Palestina trip through Egypt, and just to see firsthand some of the apartheid-like oppression of the Palestinian people. And you're right. This is another issue that politicians aren't going to talk about. They don't want to touch it. But if they are honest and they really care about humanity, they have to say, in the occupation of Palestine. And they have to say, in the billions and billions of dollars that are going to these Apache helicopters and all these other things. When I was in Palestine, I saw along the water in Gaza, along the water, I saw some children swimming, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, this is horrible. Because those children are going to get leukemia because Israel had used depleted uranium shells that exploded. And we saw what happened in Iraq. What this causes was like a 300% increase in leukemia because they're using depleted uranium against the civilian population. They're shooting down children. They're laughing about it. They're bragging about it. So this is fascism. This, and it has to end. The occupation has to end, and the U.S. has to stop being the supporter. If it wasn't for the U.S. dollars, they wouldn't be allowed to continue this oppression against it. So we have to say no, and we have to be consistently saying and raising up genocide when we see genocide happening, whether it's in Libya. I mean, there are some candidates who call themselves progressives, and they supported the war in Libya. Look at Libya right now. I can't go to Libya with dark skin because I could be taken as a hostage and in slavery. Thank you, Obama. Thank you, NATO.
David.
As I've said in many speeches before, we need to end the military-industrial complex. That's number one. For your question specifically, I'm going to make a general statement, and then I'm going to make a specific one. No country who oppresses its neighbors or citizens within its own borders should get any military aid from the United States. Any. So how much aid should Israel get in military from the United States? Zero. Goose egg. Palestine has the right to exist. Does Israel have the right to exist? Yes. Does Palestine have the right to exist? Yes. We cannot throw one under the bus or the other under the bus, but here's the deal. It's not our job to tell them how to do that. We need them to have self-determination. So we need to be a player, a neutral player on the outside, not giving a ton of aid to one side and not the other. If we're going to give humanitarian aid, make it equal. If we're going to give military aid, we're doing the wrong thing. So we need to be an equal force in this, and we're not. We say Israel is our ally in the Middle East. No, they're not. They're creating enemies for us and through us. So no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to, like I mentioned before, end the military-industrial complex, end the Saudi issue. We shouldn't be fueling their planes so they can bomb innocent civilians. We shouldn't be doing it. But we are. And when it comes down to it, it's corporate or military-industrial complex money going into the federal legislature and buying off politicians. And one of the number one people that's doing that is Senator Feinstein. When I started this campaign, out of our top 10 donors, 3 were military-industrial complex, 2 were drone manufacturers. The same drone manufacturers that are lobbing missiles into Yemen right now, probably as we speak.
It is interesting. It splits progressives, and you're right. And the reason it splits progressives is because for years Israel has been an ally. And it's an interesting situation because here you have somebody, a country, that you consider to be a friend. You consider to be an ally and to work with. And yet the strange thing with our relationship with Israel is we feel totally incapable of criticizing them. We feel totally incapable of saying to supposedly a friend, you're doing the wrong thing here. And if somebody has the nerve or the willingness to actually say that, to say, this is wrong. What you did a few weeks ago when the Palestinians were at the fence, shooting people in the back as they were running away, because at the worst, some of them weren't even doing this, but at the worst they may have been throwing stones, shooting them in the back. Not being able to say to them, that is dead wrong. What kind of an ally, what kind of a friend are we? We are looking at what is essentially, I think, in my opinion, the leader of Israel is the Trump of Israel. He is very much like Donald Trump. And I don't understand why, because I'm very critical. In fact, I was called by the San Francisco Chronicle 2 weeks ago after the shootings. And they said, okay, Senator Feinstein refuses to comment. Senator De Leon refuses to comment. Will you comment? And I said, hell yeah, I'll comment. And I'm going to tell you, we have to criticize Israel when Israel's wrong, and they're dead wrong on this, period. And I don't understand why we don't have the political courage to stand up to them when they are wrong. I believe very strongly that Israel's current policies are not only detrimental to the Palestinians, but they're messing up the Middle East because the solution in the Middle East is Iran. Iran and the ability to get Iran to come back into the international community. That's what's eventually going to solve the problems, or at least help solve the problems in the Middle East. And Israel is trying to stop that.
They're trying to prevent it. Obama, that I thought was the best thing in his administration, was the Iranian treaty and the attempt to get Iran back into the international community. Israel has tried to stop it. They are dead wrong on that, and it is going to cause problems for the next 50 years in the Middle East.
I consider the 2016 election to be nothing short of a total failure of law enforcement at every level. As we probably well know, Trump should have not been at any point qualified to be elected as president of the United States, given his dealings with Russian mobsters and with international intelligence agencies in collusion and conspiracy against the people of the United States and generally against the international community. The thing is that Trump was only able to rise to power and to be elected as president of the United States because the police officers consistently refused to enforce law against white-collar criminals, white criminals, white terrorists, and against corporate powers. The discrepancy between the targeting of poor people as compared to rich people infects and corrupts every level of our law enforcement. Basically, the real function of the police and our intelligence agencies in the United States are as political armies that are used against particularly leftist and right and radical socialists in the United States, and ignores almost totally white domestic terrorism, whether it be the KKK, the alt-Nazis, and the neo-Nazis that have risen to power. I'm wondering, why wouldn't we abolish ICE, the paramilitary model of policing in which we arm every police officer and treat them first as a primary combatant against our communities rather than a Dutch model? And why it is that we would not abolish prisons and slavery, particularly closing the exception in the 13th Amendment, which legalizes de facto and de jure slavery in the United States.
All right.
All right, there was quite a few questions in there. One, yes, I'm for banning private prisons. I'm for giving people in prison a full federal minimum wage, which would be $15 an hour and up, like I mentioned before. I'm for allowing them to vote. When it comes down to law enforcement, yes, that's one issue. But another issue is that we served up, amongst our parties, we served up two candidates in the general election. In the primary, we had options. We had, and like I've mentioned many times before, we had three options in the primary, basically. Trump got ahead, so we had Bernie and Hillary and Trump. Let's start with Hillary. Hillary was the status quo candidate. If you didn't want anything to really change and felt safe, you voted for Hillary. If you wanted to burn the system to the ground and rebuild it tomorrow, and you cared what happened the next day, you voted for Bernie. If you wanted to burn the system down completely, you voted for Trump. Then we got to the general election, and all we had left was Hillary and Trump, and people were pissed. They're anti-establishment. We're in an anti-establishment election cycle. So who'd they vote for? They voted for Trump, because they wanted to see the system burn down. Yes, there's a lot more issues with that. There's racism. There's racist groups. But I know tons of people that voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary election and then voted for Trump in the general. They weren't Democrats. They were people who crossed over. So we have a lot of work to do when it comes to police reform. I have an expansive solution for that on my website that you can look into. I don't think I have enough time to answer all the questions. If there's anything specific you want to ask right now out of what you've asked.
Well, my main contention is that there is a top level. The Nuremberg trials set
something
precedent.
Quick, because I'm going to run out
Sorry.
Of time.
There's three things: command of responsibility, ignorance before the law, and superior orders. They do not qualify. We do we
We charge individual police officers, but it is ultimately the responsibility, as somebody had said before, of the president.
Yeah, so it's the responsibility goes all the way to the top, yes, but individual officers still need to be charged. We shouldn't be charging taxpayer money for when a police officer does something wrong. That should come out of their own pocket. If we can't get it out of their own pocket, then we'll go to other methods. But when it comes to, there's culpability on every single level. So yes, we need to go after every single level.
We've got 15 minutes left for to be in this space, and we have three other questions. Okay. So we'll
make it fast.
Yeah, we'll do 1 minute responses. Okay. Thank you.
The topic you hit on is exactly right. I actually, as an attorney, one of the things that was the most unbelievable to me was when we saw 2008 and essentially the corporate world take this country to its knees, what we saw was, in fact, a lack of willingness on the part of the Department of Justice to prosecute anybody. There's a wonderful documentary, if you get a chance to see it, it was nominated for an Academy Award called Small Enough to Jail. One bank in New York got prosecuted. It was a small bank in Koreatown. I actually have talked to the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. I have several cases there. And I talked to them and I said, what in the world? You had all these people breaking all these laws and you don't go after me. I mean, it's shooting fish in a barrel. And they basically say, you know, it's going to take too many resources. We're going to have, they're going to hire expensive defense attorneys. We're going to spend years doing this. If you don't have the guts to prosecute, you shouldn't be in the prosecutor's office, period. It is a serious problem. You're talking about it. You hit a nerve with me because that is a very serious problem. We need to be prosecuting white-collar criminals in this country way, way more and prosecuting, unfortunately, people who have, you know, pot or something like that a whole lot less. It's the white-collar criminals that are getting away with murder in this country, and it's got to stop.
Well, you know, the reason that it doesn't really matter what DA you vote for or sheriff you vote for in terms of police accountability and arresting these police and prosecutors, because they have laws that are already allow the prosecutors an excuse to not have to prosecute these. Until those laws are changed, the cops can basically do whatever they want and say, I'm in fear. And the prosecutors really can't do anything. That's why Kamala Harris had a chance to change that law, but she didn't. Her sponsors didn't allow her to do that. But these laws, that's the thing that, you know, none of these things can change unless people's power comes strong. I'll tell you an example of how things did change. Well, my comrades in Durham, North Carolina, after that Unite the Right rally, it ended in the tragic death of Heather Heyer. 2 days later, they went to the Durham courthouse. They put a rope around that Confederate statue and pulled that goddamn thing down. And right after that happened, all over the nation, cities and counties voluntarily took the statues down. And now people have a different sense of whether we should allow symbols of slavery and genocide to be in public places, honored in public places. In other words, it's the struggle that changes the consciousness. It's the struggle. And as politicians, we have to help build that struggle.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul O'Rourke Babb, and I am a now retired nurse practitioner, and we've had plenty of conversation now about universal, publicly funded, I might say, single-payer health insurance, so I will not belabor it, except to say for the 56 million people in America who can't afford or don't have any health insurance, it matters greatly. I want to ask two related questions, one of which you can deal with much more quickly, and that is, what do you plan to do to preserve and protect the social and the medical health of women in this country who are under attack now? And the second is relates to that, and that is the other big attack in this government right now is on our regulatory agencies, which I believe are the people's protective agencies. What do you do to change the confirmations that we're getting and the confirmation process?
Pat.
It's a great question. You, first of all, the question about women and women's health specifically. In this country, what we have is we have set up a war on women and women's health.
We are looking at places like Alabama and Texas where you can no longer get an abortion, for example, where it's impossible, where Planned Parenthood is literally under attack, where doctors feel like they can't be safe to go into a clinic. This country in itself has the ability to go forward and push for women's equality, women's rights, but we don't have the will. And the reason we don't have the will is because we have way too many men sitting in positions of power who don't care about women's issues, who don't push them. People say to me, well, you're a man running. Yeah, I'm a man running, but I'm also a man who has pushed for women's equality for years. I grew up with a very strong and a very strong feminist household, and I believe very, very strongly that we not only have to get women's health, but women equal pay. To answer your question about regulations, I believe very, very strongly that this country, you use the word, and it's exactly right. It's not regulations, they're protections. We keep using that word regulations. They're not regulations. We are protecting. We're protecting the environment. We're protecting our people from all kinds of things, the FDA, down on down to the EPA throughout. It's protections. We have to get across to people. These are not negatives. These are things that are positive. They're making our lives better every single day and making our lives safe.
You know, we need to have an equal rights amendment that doesn't allow any excuses for having different wages for men and women. Number one, we need to make sure that everyone has the right to reproductive rights, the right to an abortion. We need to make sure that misogyny laws are in place so much so that President Trump would be in jail right now. And we need to have, like I said, with the unions, a certain percentage of the legislature should be unions. A certain percentage of the legislature should be women as well to account for the past oppression and the past discrimination. That's just one of the things.
So yes, single-payer health care is going to be the obvious answer, but when we pass single-payer health care, we have other sides that work in the legislature. So we need to make sure we protect abortion rights for women, women's health rights. Right now, basically, we're treating women differently than we're treating men. When men can go in and get a prescription for Viagra, and that's covered by their health insurance, but women can't get birth control under some health insurances because of religious issues, that's an issue. When we have constant attacks on women's right, and when we talk about women's pay, that's an issue. But there's another issue that we're not talking about. That's inclusivity. So it's not just about women. It's about Hispanic women who only make 50 cents on the dollar to a white man. 50 cents. So when we talk about making wage fair for everybody, we need to make wage fair for everybody. We need to have health care for trans people. Not, oh, you have to go to this special doctor over here. We can have specialized doctors. But this one game in town, basically, doctor, we need to have that across the board included in the single-payer system. So we need to have equality across the board, but it needs to be inclusive. And we need to include everyone in that.
Hi, I'm Dr. Wes Becker. Wes like Wesley Snipes and Becker like Boris Becker. I'm the elected president of Habeas Clubs International out of San Francisco, and I loved hearing everything that you had to say tonight. I like the way you started out explaining how we need to make courageous decisions as senators. I'm wondering what each of you has to say about this antiquated, absolutely goofball system of the Electoral College.
I'm okay with getting rid of it, if that answers the question. I think that we need to be more representative. I have friends who want to go straight to a parliamentarian system and get rid of the job that I'm running for, because it's not representative. So when it comes down to it, we need to represent the will of the people. I like Maine's thing where they have two different senators for two different parts of the state. I think we should do that here. When it comes down to it, we need to fight for democracy. We need to fight for the people's will. That's what we're based upon. We're based upon representation. We're a representative democracy. We're not an electoral college democracy. We're not let's have the person who got the least amount of votes win democracy. We're a representative democracy, so it's time to represent.
It's interesting.
It's interesting that when Obama and Hillary Clinton decided to facilitate the overthrow of Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009, he was the elected president, a socialist president in Honduras, and the U.S. facilitated his overthrow. And they use the excuse that, oh, well, they weren't democratic. And then they say the same thing about Syria. They say the same thing about Venezuela. What do these, all these things places have in common? They didn't have an electoral system. It was one person, one vote. This is the country where it's not democratic at all. And I think it was Tilden and Hayes during right after Reconstruction that where they made their compromise and they got the Union soldiers out of the South and then the Klan was able to take over. But that was just one of the instances. But it's been a few, many times over that the, maybe during Coolidge as well, the electoral system was used to not for the will of the people, but to defy the will of the people. So we'd have to get rid of it now.
I think one of the, in college I studied the Revolutionary War period. That was, I was a history major. And I think one of the things that you learn when you study the period is how amazingly, how good the founding fathers were at sort of predicting the future and having an idea. On the flip side of that, this concept that we have grown up with or in this country that it is infallible is ridiculous. You're talking about a document that was drafted in a country that was 250 years old now. You know, the founding fathers didn't have very much of a clue about the internet, okay? They didn't have very much clue about what's gonna the country's gonna be about in terms of 250 years later. What I'm getting at is this. We have to move into the modern ages with a number of things. Just because it's in the Constitution, just because it's the way it was done, that doesn't mean the way it's got to be the way it's always been done. We've got to abolish the Electoral College. It was an idea whose time is way past. There are a number of things, though, not just the Electoral College. There are a number of things in the criminal justice system. There are a number of things throughout the Constitution that this concept you hear from conservatives, we can't change the Constitution. It's dead wrong. It's a 250-year-old document. It needs changing. It needs updating. It needs reform.
Yeah, Benson here. I'm going to make two quick, concise statements, and the question's going to be, what do you think? First of all, our Constitution was created to protect us from the federal government. Right now, we need something in our Constitution that protects us from corporations, much like the first Constitution protected us from the federal government. In the early 1900s, it was established in this country that the Constitution protected the property rights of corporations, but not the personal rights. This has been eroded ever since, and that's how we got the Citizens United decision. The second one addresses what David was saying about silos. We've got to get rid of tribalism, identity politics, and we've got to move into we the people, equality for all. All people were created, and all lives matter. It's medical care for all, justice for all. And the question is, what do you think?
We live in a society that is run by folks who own the land, the machines, and the factories. So they decide what laws are created, what laws they abide by, what laws they don't abide by. So, yeah, we have to change any institutions, whatever, we have to change the laws to that really help to take that power from them. And they're not going to allow you to do that on your own. In order to do that, you're going to need to build up your own troops, your own unify your own forces, the working class, the working and poor people. We are the majority. We create the wealth. But in order to do that, you have to listen to, we're all not all the same. So you have to listen to what the LGBTQ community says, or what the black community says, or what the Latinx community says, and all of these, and the women say, and this. They all have different, they're all being attacked by capitalism in different ways. So we have to listen to their identity, and listen to their struggles, and be in solidarity with their struggles. That's the only way we're gonna be able to unite to fight this common enemy, which is the ruling class.
The reason that Senator Feinstein is vulnerable, the reason that Kevin DeLeon cannot win in this state, is because they're exactly what you're talking about. This isn't a state where it's Democrat versus Republican. It's not a state where we're fighting those kind of fights. What we're fighting is, it's a state in a country where we're fighting, it's Wall Street versus working people. And this state is filled with working people who need a voice, working people who are dying to be heard. I've gone all around this state. This is my 9th time in Chico, by the way, today. I've been here 9 times. I've been in places like Tuolumne County 4 or 5 times. Redding, you've seen me repeatedly. You got to get out and talk to people. And I tell the story because it's critical that we get these people, independents, Republicans, who are working men and women. We have the right program for them. Progressives are the right program for them. We are the program for working people. I was in a bar in Tuolumne County. I won't tell you why I was in the bar, but I was there with 3 guys who were sitting there telling me how in the world could I be a Democrat. They were screaming at it. By the time I finished talking about the platform, every single one of them said they'd vote for me because they understand it's working people versus Wall Street. That's the message, and that's what we've got to get across.
In the interest of time, yes, I'm for a constitutional amendment to protect us from corporations, and yes, we're going to all have to unify to get that done. You are well aware that amendment to the Constitution is not something we just pass tomorrow. So we need to unify, get out of our silos, and actually do that. And I think we're almost out of time, so I'll just leave it at that.
Fellas, I had a moderator question for you that's really important, not just to me, but to my generation, and that is carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are over 410 parts per million. Historically, throughout time, they've never been greater than 350. What are you going to do?
Start. We've talked, you hear a lot of talk, obviously, about renewables and having 100% renewables by 2035 or 2040. I don't think there's any question that's the direction we need to go. Wind, solar, water. We are headed in that direction. We are obviously having huge setbacks with the Trump administration, but that's the direction this country is going. That's the direction the world is going. We are going to achieve it. I believe very strongly we will get there. But there are a number of other things we got to talk about that go beyond just wind, water, and solar power. One of them I talk about repeatedly that is extremely important is regenerative agriculture. Regenerative agriculture is one of the single most important things we can do to bring, because it not only does it bring carbon back from the atmosphere into the soil, but it is a process by which farmers, because it makes the soil retain water more, it produces greater crops, they make more money. It's a very sellable issue to farmers because it's economically great for them. Regenerative agriculture is one of those policies, one of many type of policies. Those are the things we've got to use to be innovative, to go beyond just wind, solar, and the things we talk about in water power that are talked about in 100% renewables. We've got to be innovative and imaginative.
We got to see that the destruction of our earth, the warming of the planet, the endless wars, the policies of Trump that are escalating, the record deportations and the endless wars of the Obama administration, all of these are consistent, and all of these are a part of this system. And they're not going to change by electing this one or that one. The Arctic caps are melting. They were melting under the Trump administration and the Democratic administration. Both are responsible because they don't have control over the industries that are causing this crisis because they're worried about maximizing profits, not about destroying the earth. That's why it's the socialist countries that are ones that are leading in the fighting of global warming today. Cuba, and some people don't like China, but hey, they're the ones that are spending. They've already passed the Paris Accords. The U.S. has done nothing. So the reason that is happening is because there's not a profit motive. So if there's no profit motive, then you can do what you need to do to save humanity. We got to get rid of that profit motive for the sake of ourselves and our children.
So I was one of the first supporters and endorsers of Tulsi Gabbard's OFF Act when she released it. That's 100% renewable energy by 2035. Currently, we have incrementalist policies. Here in California, we have cap and trade, and everyone's like, well, yeah, that's so environmental. What's environmental about allowing companies to sell their pollutions to other companies and allowing companies in rich areas to move their pollution to a different company in a poor area, an area where they have no voice, where they have no money to have a voice. We can't move pollution around and fix the problem. The pollution is a global issue, as mentioned. It's a climate change issue. So if the oil factories in Richmond, instead of San Francisco, or instead of LA, which they actually have plenty of oil down there, that's not solving the problem if we just move it to a different area. It's still emitting the same amount of toxins. So we need to get off this incrementalist approach. We need bolder ideas like Tulsi Gabbard's OFF Act, and that's how we're gonna get there. We're not gonna get there by sitting on our hands and passing what the corporations allow us to. And that's where it always will come back to, is those corporations who control Washington and Sacramento.
Yeah, I'm gonna be closing with the last question. Again, my name is Allie Metters-Knight, I'm a Chupta Indian tribe. We've seen this year Standing Rock. We've seen the pipelines come through the United States. We have a huge, huge support group in the community that are non-native who see the land in trust, these protected land, these treaty agreements, as the last resort of the last stand for environmental protections. And we have seen the executive department of our three-branch government assume legislation, assume to the policies and regulations on environmental practices. My question as for senators is, how do you reclaim your power back from the executive branch and demonstrate it to the people? How would you plan on doing that?
We need to reunify the legislature and actually have a spine in the legislature. And the reason we don't now is goes back to, again, corporate donations. I had friends who left the Bernie Sanders volunteer office in Sacramento and went to Standing Rock. I couldn't go at the time, but they did. So they were there. We have several other pipelines in America that are currently going through other Indian lands. So we need to shut that all down. We not only need to shut down the current pipelines and keep it in the ground, but we need to shut down the current pipelines and stop any further pipelines from going forward. So yes, this is the front line, and you can see how people react to it. Oh, those hippies and Indians out there trying to stop this pipeline, we need that oil. That's how they react to it. We need to change that message. We need people that are willing to have the spine enough to go out there to those areas, like some politicians did in 2016, and actually speak out from that source.
Well, the first thing I guess we got to do is recognize, like I said, over and over again, the system that we're in and the power that we don't have. But if we're honest politicians and we really want to do the right thing, look at all of the veterans that got involved in the No Doppel and that came out to defend, and all of the public support that there was. So the people are there. The people are ready. They just need some kind of leadership. So everybody who would, if I were to be elected in the senator, everybody who voted for me, I'd have a staff calling them, organizing, grassroots, through this. Let's go to that. Let's go sit and surround the area of the demonstrations of the pipeline. Dare those cops and those, I call them pigs, to shoot us down and use their water to freeze us at night. Dare them to do. And if there's some other problems in some other industry, I'd galvanize the forces. Let's go. Let's organize. Let's get to there. Let's sit in at these places. Now, this might land me in jail, or it might make me in my office, but the kind of consciousness that would build will do a hell of a lot more than any of these politicians sitting around for 1,000 years looking at a book and figuring out what legislation to have to not offend their corporate sponsors.
Well, to answer your question, I think the reason there is the executive has sort of surpassed the other two branches, specifically the legislative branch, is because there is a void in the legislative branch of leadership. There's a void of courage. Most specifically, and I think I was talking about this earlier, there is no plan. There is no agenda. There is nothing, especially from the legislative angle. There is nothing that we stand for. I think the most frustrating thing for those of us who are running for office, who are out there, who are activists, who are pushing, this concept that somehow or another we're just going to wishy-washy way our way in, and we're going to get up and say nice little things here and there. We're going to raise money. We're going to take money from corporations, and we're going to continue the way things are going, which is what you see from Senator Feinstein, what you see from Kevin DeLeon. It's just more of the same, more of the establishment. It's causing a void of a lack of leadership, and the executive has stepped in and is filling that void. We've got to have the courage, and I find it fascinating to me that Bernie Sanders was criticized by Democrats saying, well, he's not even part of the Democratic Party, but yet it was Bernie Sanders who actually had to bring Democratic principles back to the Democratic Party.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for showing up here in the North State in Chico, California. We're so grateful to have you here. And thank you, folks in the audience, everyone with their questions, and everybody who also showed up today. Please like our Rev Chico online. Please support us so that we can hold more independent town halls. And we wish you the best. Go out and vote on June 5th.